Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams broadcasting to you from sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK. We've got two guests for you this week and we're going to have a discussion about the latest ammonia engine developments and think about the CII and how much more efficient current engines can become. And in particular, think about what policy developments need to happen from an engineering perspective in order to drive shipping's energy transition. So my two guests this week, first of all, are Tim Scarborough. Tim is Director of Maritime at Ricardo. Tim has directed a number of high-profile techno-economic and policy studies for policymakers, such as the European Commission and the IMO. He also works with individual ports and shipping industry customers on their journeys to reduce their environmental impacts. His clients value his expertise from his policy insights, strategy delivery, and implementation projects, drawing on cross-sectoral insights and an evidence-driven approach. Tim has expertise in low and zero carbon fuels and their production pathways, on energy efficiency and emission abatement technologies, emission inventorying, life cycle assessment, and the policies regulating the maritime sector. Our second guest today is Tony Stoichevsky from Wärtsilä. He is General Manager for Project Sales and Development. He's currently working in this role and is accountable for business development with focus on large projects in the marine industry in Northern Europe. He's been working in various positions at Wärtsilä for 22 years and has a broad experience in the marine industry, especially within the field of medium-speed combustion engines and alternative fuels. Tony was actually responsible for the methanol development project, which resulted in the conversion of the four main engines on board Germanica, the first ship in the world to operate with methanol as a fuel. So without further ado, let's hear what Tony and Tim have to tell us. Welcome to the podcast. Great to have you both on.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you, Mark.
So if I may start with Tim, please. There's been a lot of policy developments in 2023. What do you think we should be looking out for in 2024?
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, what are we going to look out for this coming year? So we're really on the cusp of change. There's a lot of developments. We could think about it at EU and at IMO level. So in the EU, you've got the EU ETS, you've got a big year coming up for 2024. It's the first year for the MRV. So that means that, you know, the ship owners, operators need to be monitoring, reporting according to a new monitoring plan for the first time. And that's going to be the first year that they need to ultimately relinquish allowances for. So the economics are going to start to bite. That's over a phase-in period, though, so it's not, they don't have to relinquish allowances for 100% of their emissions from the first year, which is 2024, but they're going to be doing that over the next 3 years. So the economics are going to become more and more apparent and coming into their decision-making. And we also know that it's not just the CO2. So we've got comprehensive coverage for methane and nitrous oxide. They're not quite starting from the first year, but from 2026. And overall, those costs under the EU ETS are not insignificant. You know, if you think about an example where, you know, today prices of VLSFO, about 600 euros a ton, and the CO2 allowance prices have been up to about 100 euros a ton over the last year. So that's going to add on a 50% increase for fuel costs, for what is, you know, for many, the largest component of vessel operating costs. So, yeah, this is serious stuff. It's gonna be great in terms of driving efficiency improvements, and it's going to begin the thinking on switching to alternative fuels.
Bunker prices have been 50% higher than they are today in the past, and that hasn't driven too much in the way of efficiencies. Is this a, do you think it's specifically policy that will drive rather than operational efficiencies?
I think a step change of 50%, you know, overnight, you know, you can't ignore that, and that's going to have a significant impact. And that underlying variability of the bunker prices will still exist. This will just be on top. So, yeah, I do think that will play a role. And then you've got to think about, you know, the other regulations that are coming in at the EU level as well. You know, we must recall you've got the Fuel EU Maritime was just published a couple of months ago, September. And this is what brings in the ceiling on the greenhouse gas intensity of the energy use on board. And that requirement steps in 2025. You know, this is really short-term stuff. VLSFO used on its own is not going to cut it. So vessel operators are going to need to do something already from 2025. And you can see with the factors as well that longer term, LNG won't be possible to be used on its own from 2040. So, you know, there's a gamut of regulations, legislation coming in that I think together is really going to be driving not only energy efficiency changes, but also switches to alternative fuel.
Tony, from the engine manufacturer's point of view, what would you say to that now?
I mean, I can first conclude with Tim that never in the past we had so much momentum as we have today, and the transformation what we are seeing today is nothing that we can compare to before. You mentioned fuel prices have been 50% higher in the past. That's true, but there have not been any alternatives. What we are seeing today is we are seeing a shift which is planned on several levels in the industry and which is backed by both demand and supply from technology and governments and all stakeholders in the industry. From our perspective as, let's say, an energy manufacturer in this industry, we are fully aligned with the long-term trends. And we believe that we can lead this transformation with solutions that are available for the industry. So just recently, last week, we have released the first commercially available four-stroke engine that can run on ammonia as a fuel. And we see this as a major milestone in the industry where solutions are there that can decarbonize maritime in the future.
Does four-stroke have a particular advantage over two-stroke for ammonia, or is it to do with greater operational flexibility?
I mean, the four-stroke engines are different to two-stroke engines, even if basically they operate in a similar way. The four-stroke flexibility is that the engine is much more compact and modularized and can be set in a multi-engine installation, while two-stroke engines are predominantly used as a single propulsion source on a large merchant vessel. So we cover different segments with each of the engines, but I believe that the ammonia would be available for the two-stroke engines as well.
You co-wrote a paper about ammonia a few months ago, didn't you? Was this the sailing on solar paper?
Yeah, well, that was something that was quite a long time ago now, and it's been really interesting to see the evolution of ammonia as a considered solution, because when I co-wrote that paper with Nick Ash back in 2019, people weren't really talking about ammonia, and this was one of those papers, the seminal study, that sort of laid out all of the arguments and said ultimately, okay, yeah, challenges, put your hand up to that, fine. But there's some great potential here for decarbonizing the industry, but also bringing about potential economic developments for countries around the world who've got, you know, rich and renewable resources. So, you know, there's the potential for some win-wins. So, you know, I'm not behind a particular fuel, and, you know, we started to talk about ammonia just now, but there's so many opportunities across electrofuels more widely, because all in needing very large quantities of renewable energy to underpin them. And those points about providing opportunities for economic development in countries rich in resources still stands. So I think it's a great potential story.
Well, just while we're on ammonia, what do you both see at the moment as the key advantages or challenges of ammonia as a marine fuel? People talk about toxicity, people talk about the lack of availability of green ammonia, but these can be overcome with time, can't they?
So ammonia is a widely traded commodity, and there is a well-established procedure of ammonia handling. And applying that as a fuel, it's not so new either. We have had, during the Second World War, ammonia used as a fuel and in various applications due to the shortage of other fuels. But when applying it on a four-stroke marine engine, we are building this on experience with LNG before. So we have a robust, well-proven system in function, and then add the design criteria which are needed for ammonia handling with a special focus on safety. When it comes to using ammonia as a fuel, there are challenges. The fuel is quite inert and it's very hard to combust. So it's not like, let's say, methanol as alternative, which is a much more combustible fuel. Ammonia is much harder to combust, so there are special consideration needs to be taken in the engine design. And it also requires a strong ignition source. And this is where we use pilot fuel to start the combustion and then continue the combustion with ammonia energy. I think as from production perspective, we can see that renewable energy is required to produce all electrofuels and ammonia, of course, because all of them have the origin in hydrogen. But the benefit of ammonia today currently is the production of blue ammonia, where in certain cases the carbon sequestration can be done at the source, and hydrogen can be produced from natural gas with carbon capture directly back to the carbon origin. And this brings very good advantage where carbon can be stored permanently, and ammonia with a very low CO2 footprint can be provided to the shipping industry in large volumes eventually.
You mentioned the inert nature of ammonia. I believe, not being a chemist, but this is due to the high quantity of nitrogen, which is an inert gas, and 70% of the atmosphere is.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So it's hard to combust the nitrogen content in the fuel.
But does this mean on combustion that ammonia produces oxides of nitrogen? We've got regulations about those as well.
That's true. However, nitrogen oxides are produced from the nitrogen in the air, and they are produced due to combustion temperature. But we do need high combustion temperature in order to combust ammonia in a good way. So both NOx is emitted, but we do handle NOx with a catalyst. So the ammonia solution, the ammonia engine solution would require a catalytic reducer for handling the NOx. And we also see that there is a risk of emitting laughing gas. So this is nitrous oxide, which have a potency of 300 times the CO2. So we can deal with this in a combustion technology, where we tweak and tune the engine in order to minimize the emission of nitrous oxide laughing gas as well. And there are also technologies that further the catalytic reducer can reduce the nitrous oxide as well. So we can say that on our latest engine, preliminary CO2 reduction is on average around 70% across the whole engine range. And we can also say that on certain engine ranges load, on certain engine load range, we are achieving a very high ammonia energy share and very high CO2 reduction.
It's great to hear that the industry is already anticipating, you know, these wider life cycle considerations, you know, so that we're not, you know, repeating the mistakes that we made in the past of not, for example, thinking about methane releases. So we're already thinking about, as an industry, hey, okay, well, if we're switching fuel, well, what are the wider life cycle issues here? And clearly, as Tony mentioned, you know, what you don't want to do is switch to another fuel and then have some N2O, some nitrous oxide slip that's going to remove all those potential benefits, you know, ammonia being a carbon-free fuel. So I think it's great that we're in that position already, but they seem to be, you know, technologically solvable challenges. You know, you mentioned, Tony, as well, we can roll out selective catalytic reduction to solve NOx issues that aren't any worse than you get with some other fuels. So I think that's a great story.
And then the availability of the fuel is a key issue, I suppose. Most of the ammonia that's currently made is already promised, if you like, to the fertilizer.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's all going to need to be additional. And, you know, if you were to look at the quantities that are currently manufactured, produced of ammonia globally, adding a shipping demand on top of that, if it turned out that ammonia was to become the largest fuel, if, you know, that's a major change for that industry. But I know that industry overall is recognizing that potential. And is on the pathway to understanding what the potential is for supply of that, not only You know, Tony mentioned blue, but also green ammonia. And we put these colours as labels, but you know, the industry is ahead of that, those sort of gross overall labels, and thinking ahead to certification, because you know, one molecule of grey ammonia versus blue versus green all looks the same once you put it in a tank. So you know, the policies that we mentioned earlier are going to need and will drive markets in certification. So it's great to know that, you know, people like the Ammonia Energy Association are on the topic already, because it's going to be really important to know the provenance. A fuel supplier and a fuel, someone coming into to bunker wants to know from the fuel supplier, you know, what is the carbon intensity? They're going to need to report it in those policies that we just described earlier. And so that fuel supplier needs to know. And that means, you know, there's a full assessment needed of that pathway and the greenhouse gas intensity. So we're going to have a lot more transparency in the future compared to we had in the past.
I think transparency is one of the key topics, that key memes that comes out of the whole decarbonisation debate. The shipping industry is having to become more transparent than it's used to be in the past.
It's a bit contradictory, because the shipping industry have been everything but transparent in the past. So that cultural change, let's call it cultural change, it's a huge challenge for the shipping industry, because it's less regulated, it's international, there is a flag state, there is a classification, there is other type of mutual ownership and investment banks into structure, which are not very transparent. And they need to realize that now they all of us need to collaborate and work together at a joint target. So I see some challenges, but I also see, if you look into the, let's say, in the order book of new build vessels in 2022, 50% of the order book was alternative fuel notation ready, and in 23 I think it's around 40% of the order book of new build ships which are supposed to be prepared for alternative fuels for the future. So changes are happening.
Do you know either of you or any of those orders for ammonia engines?
I can speak for us that we have recently signed the first letter of intent for the first ammonia engine just released. So we expect to have ammonia engines in operation 2 years from now, fully in operation. And of course, shipbuilding takes some time, and our engines would be delivered before. But early 25, maybe engine delivery and a full operation 2 years from now. So things are happening in the market, yes.
This is great, because it helps gain some of those steps needed towards the what the policymakers are requesting and requiring. So if you think back to what got agreed at the IMO in the summer as part of the greenhouse gas strategy, there was the 5% striving for 10% of zero or near zero greenhouse gas fuels by 2030, and clearly that's a major way to try and get us on the transition. You know. With the introduction of new fuels, and having, you know, hearing Tony say that Wärtsilä is expecting ammonia engines to be in use from 2026, I think this is great, because this is going to help us on that pathway. And you need these sorts of early stages in order to prove that it's going to work, and then others can learn and follow.
I would like to add that one thing which is really important in this industry is governmental support for the new pilot projects. We can be very honest and say that the new technologies, they are more expensive, and the new fuels are much more expensive than the conventional fuels. So in order to make these changes and to have this scaling effect on the technology development, we need collaboration across the industry and also governmental support for this new pilot project. So once the new pilot projects have been launched, I think the scaling up and the adoption would go much faster. But in order for that to happen, we need more support and more pilot projects.
Yeah, I agree. And you got to think both, I guess, from a CapEx and OpEx perspective, because you know, you can get funding instruments to help you with some capital costs that might be getting incurred, and you know, you could think about the vessel side, but you know, let's not forget the the landside infrastructure is going to be a massive, and the majority of the cost to be incurred overall for the industry. But those investments won't get over that hurdle of the additional cost of a fuel compared to a conventional fuel. So that's an ongoing operating cost difference. Those policies that we mentioned earlier might help to bridge some of that gap, but probably not all of it. So there's going to be a residual need for continued support.
We can also say that, of course, early adopters, they take a lot of risk in investment in these technologies, and this risk needs to be offset by in one way or the other. But also, as I said earlier, there are 60,000 merchant vessels in operation today. I mean, the scrapping ratio is around 800 vessels per year. And we have three times more vessels built compared to the scrapping. So we can say that in 20 years from now, many of the vessels which are currently operating, they will be still operating. And if you sit and wait for the future technologies today, you will only increase your cost of investment in the future, because things will not get cheaper. And if you are putting off investments to the final date, you will come in a scenario where there is no capacity. I mean, we cannot build more ships than what we are building today because of capacity. And you cannot convert more vessels to alternative fuels than what there is capacity in the shipyard. So not only for early adopters or first movers, but industry needs to really plan and start to making these changes in order not to end up with very high costs down the road.
And this is one of the reasons why, one of the conclusions that we put in the paper that we authored for the IMO earlier this year, the one that fed into MEPC 80 this summer, that was effectively what the IMO Secretariat wanted, is the evidence base to show to the member states around the world that, no, hey, a more feasible, a more ambitious greenhouse gas strategy was more feasible. And one of the key conclusions in that was that, you know, you need to have the energy efficiency measures alongside the switches to alternative fuels, because the costs of alternative fuels are going to be higher in the future. You need to make the ships as efficient as possible earlier on. And that provides as well the opportunity for reductions in the shorter term, because, you know, we know what the science is telling us. It's not about the end goal of reaching net zero in 2050. It's our total cumulative emissions over that journey is what's important. So getting the emissions down as fast and as early as possible is key for mitigating climate change. So yeah, I agree with you, Tony. As you say, you know, you need to tackle not only those future ships that are going to be switching to alternative fuels, but addressing each and every one of those ships that are already being produced today. And, you know, the solutions for those are energy efficiency measures, operational measures. Those ones can have the drop-in fuel options that many are considering today as what is available today. And in the future, you've got CCS options as well, potentially, if that technology can get developed and is retrofittable. You know, these are all options on the table that need to get further explored.
Yeah, on that basis, with today's ships, I mean, how much more efficient can fuel oil or diesel oil engines get? You know, you can put drop-in biofuels or even e-fuels in, but how much further can the envelope be pushed before we just have to move to another technology?
It's a very good question, Mark. And I was reflecting on this. When we talk about engine efficiency, I think in a commercially viable engine, we are around 50% of the thermal efficiency. So 50% of the fuel, of the energy in the fuel, it is going to end up on the axis of the propeller, and the other 50% are heat and other waste. So I don't believe that we can do small incremental changes for the future, but the engine efficiency will not be something that can breach the gap. New technologies will be needed further down the road. But if you look into the next 10 to 15 years, I think still the internal combustion engine is the best energy converter you could have in maritime industry for various reasons. And on this topic, it's very important to choose the most efficient engine technology, because future fuels, they will cost maybe four times more than conventional fuel. And if you have an engine technology which is 2.5% better in fuel consumption compared to other, and you're comparing these two, you need to remember that it's not only 2.5%, it is 2.5% times 4 in sum down the road because of the cost of the new fuel. So even these small differences will be very important. And as an engine manufacturer, when we develop engines to alternative fuels, first we are developing them to be, let's say, a fuel indifferent. So if you buy an engine from Wärtsilä today, you can be sure that that engine will be capable to operate on whatever the fuel might be in the future, with minor conversion, of course, not from start. But that is a promise that we can make, and this is our ideology. Then the second ideology is to make the efficient as at least as efficient as possible compared to conventional fuels. As said, ammonia is not the best fuel. If it was the best fuel, it would be used much earlier. But it's much worse. So our design criteria and strategies to have the engine perform as closely as possible to the diesel efficiency and not lose any efficiency with these new alternative fuels.
Some of the points that we're coming to here is that there's a variety of fuel options available. Yeah, we've name checked some of them today, but there's several on the table, and the use cases of different vessel types will demand different fuels. You talked about internal combustion engines. We're relatively close to the ceiling of efficiencies on internal combustion engines. And they are highly efficient. We should recognise that. Other options may exist too. And fuel cells have been talked about for a long time, for example, can accommodate a variety of fuels. And they offer some particularly interesting opportunities. So, for example, Ricardo's in a consortium delivering a Horizon Europe project called the SHIPES study. And this is developing containerized hydrogen fuel cell solution for application passenger ferries, crews. And this is really being driven by the want for some zero emission operation in some pristine and quiet environment. So a hydrogen fuel cell provides potentially a short term power propulsion in these Norwegian fjords, for example, that they can be with much reduced noise, vibration, so different benefits. So you've got different applications requiring different needs, and I think in the future we've got a variety of options on the table today, all being developed, and many of them are going to get taken further forward. I think we also can see electrification happening at a faster rate than perhaps we anticipated. There's a lot going on in ports, obviously, with provision of shore power and things like that, thinking about the alternative fuels infrastructure regulation coming in. But the electrification themselves of vessels is being talked about a little bit more, obviously not transoceanic, but clearly some short hops. The English Channel comes to mind as the potential for battery electric. And I think that's another one to throw into the mix.
I see the European Maritime Safety Industry Association, EMSA, has just brought out guidelines for batteries and electrical storage systems on ships. So there is policy developments there to go along with the technological development.
I mean, if you continue on electrification, I think that's the, in some scenarios in the future, if batteries could achieve the energy density equal to fuel, and we have grids that can support the transfer of energy charging these batteries, that's a perfect solution for shipping. It's the best solution we can have, because the energy loss between production and propeller would be roughly 10%. If you look into the path of energy loss on producing electrofuels and then combusting these electrofuels in a combustion engine, reducing the energy efficiency further down and going to propeller, maybe we can find the loss up to 80%. So it's great if we can electrify the whole shipping and skip all fuels and just use the electrons directly to the propeller.
It's an interesting concept, and certainly that's pushing us towards life cycle assessment, isn't it? Because it's sort of saying, right, well, for the particular use case, you know, where are you going to get the most efficient use of that energy? But then we also need to think about, right, well, there's a different upstream pathway of getting that energy. You've got obviously the production of the electricity, but you've got some entirely different technologies on board. So instead of thinking about the materials that go into an engine, you've got the materials that go into a battery. And the amount that you're making use of a vessel, the more that you make use of it, is going to offset the additional life cycle energy embodied and greenhouse gas emissions embodied in a production of a battery. I think that trade-off is becoming more widely known now, that yes, a battery's got some more embodied greenhouse gas emissions upstream, but if you're making use of it more, then that's going to be overall a payoff. Actually, that's definitely something that came out in we had a life cycle assessment study get published last week from Ricardo, supporting Icomia. So thinking about smaller vessels than we've been thinking about today in this podcast, but certainly it was pointing to the need for understanding the use cases of all your different vessel types, and for some of those smaller vessels that aren't used much in the year, drop-in fuel options are clearly going to be a bit more beneficial than some of those battery options that might need a larger payoff if they were used more.
Do you think either of you at this point in the debate, at this stage, are at the bottom of the S-curve of the energy transition, technologically and in terms of the number of vessels that have diverted from the fuel oil? Are there any conclusions we can draw at the moment about how this energy transition for shipping is going to go, or are we all still far too early in the process?
I think we've got some fantastic green shoots to support and champion, haven't we? You know, there's been a lot in the news, in the maritime news, I should say, about green methanol, and that being used for the first time by some major operators, and that's fantastic. And clearly, if that's getting proven at those scales, others are going to follow suit. And it's those sorts of trigger points that we need to help us transition to those sorts of checkpoints that I mentioned earlier, the 5% striving for 10% of new fuels by 2030. And it's the point of that 5%, and I think was really sort of borne out of wording that I think the Getting to Zero Coalition masterminded, that we need those trigger points because that's going to then enable a snowball effect of rolling out these alternative fuels. The difficult bit that's been facing the industry is you can't just make incremental changes over time and we will get to net zero, because some of these fuels are step changes. So this is why we need these pilot projects that are showing us the way with alternative fuels. So I think there's a lot to celebrate with those pilot projects. We need to continue more with them. It'd be great to see some projects with ammonia, so you can get learnings from an additional fuel as well. And the more knowledge that can be shared on all of these pilot projects, then the faster the rate of rollout.
I think if you ask what is the solution for the future, you will get a number of various answers depending on who you're asking. And objectivity is a challenge in the industry. We are an engine manufacturer as our main business, and our engines should be, as said, indifferent to what the fuel solution might be for the future. But it's not so easy to say that the engine complexity in a ship, the engine complexity compared to alternative fuel, it's a minor part of the vessel complexity of handling these fuels. So the vessels which have chosen to be LNG fuel today, they will, with the highest probability, remain to be LNG fueled in the future as well. Diesel vessels can convert to alternative fuels, but also maybe the easiest would be to operate them on biofuels, if biofuels are sustainable and available. If not, then the diesel vessels can convert. What I would like to say is that 80% of the complexity and also a very large percent of the cost is the choice of actual fuel. So when you will choose an LNG or ammonia or methanol, you are bound to that. You cannot change from ammonia to methanol or from methanol to LNG because it will require a major change all again on the vessel. So the engine is the easy part, we say, and it's not the bottleneck. It can be easily converted compared to the large conversion of the vessels in the future.
Tony, I'm glad you mentioned the wider sustainability considerations, because you talked about a potential switch. You know, if someone's used LNG so far, what are their options? You know, they can, in the future, potentially there might be a synthetic methane and e-methane. There could be biomethane, both of which would be drop-in options. And there's some work we're supporting the IMO on at the moment, actually, about thinking about feeding into the LCA guidelines that are going to continue to get developed by the IMO. We're supporting on those wider sustainability considerations, because, you know, let's not just think narrow-minded about greenhouse gas emissions only. There's a whole gamut of environmental considerations that need to be taken into account. And biofuels in particular, there's a lot of topics there which are difficult and challenging, but we need to consider them, because there's some wider issues at stake. You know, food, there's the food and food versus feed debate, etc., etc.
Listen, we're getting to the end of our time, so before we finish, I just want to wrap up by asking, you know, we're getting towards December 2023, so it's quite late in the year to be asking people this, but are either of you out on the road? Have you got any conferences or events planned where people, if they've got follow-up questions that they're burning to ask you while they've been listening to this, can come and approach you and talk to you?
Well, in the shorter term, I'm expecting to speak at the IMO steering group on life cycle assessment, which is going to be in a few weeks at the IMO, mid-December. And I'm sure there are some conferences coming up that I've got speaking slots for. I think there's one in May in Barcelona, but that's a little bit further ahead. I need to recheck my diary for something shorter term.
I think the next plan for me and confirmed is the OSJ in London in February next year. But we are plenty of people like me in Wärtsilä. Wärtsilä is a big company, and we our strategy is to be present everywhere we can, because again, collaboration and sharing the lessons learned and sharing the views from technology perspective and other is really important. So we are very open to collaborate with all the industry and are open to connect and talk about these things wherever needed.
Well, on that note, thank you both for collaborating and cooperating to join us on the Ship Energy podcast. Really appreciate you both taking the time out of your schedules. Thank you ever so much for your contribution today.
Thanks very much for having us.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks.
And to everybody out there in listener land, hope you're having a good week, and tune in next time for another exciting episode of the Ship Energy podcast. For now, this is Mark Williams from Cambridge signing off, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye for now.